As COVID-19 spreads, people are scrambling to adjust to new rules and a new reality. Stand 6 feet apart. A friend's sister is carrying a yardstick. Someone comes too close, she brandishes it. En garde, get away. Then there's no parties, no gatherings, no haircut or color. And for business, unless you are essential, shutter your doors. All in the name of public health. But what is that? And when does it come before personal freedoms or earning a living? Professor Lawrence Gostin has dedicated his life to these questions. He's director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University and director of the WHO Center on Global Health Law. Professor, it would seem like we know what public health is, but is there a formal definition?
Yes, there actually is. I mean, it's I think the best definition is what we can do collectively as a society to keep ourselves healthy and safe. And, of course, the primary responsibility falls to government and particularly cities and states because they hold the primary public health duties and powers.
But then they ask us to do things. So let's start with the government. The Secretary of Health and Human Services issued a public health emergency under the Public Health Service Act. Then on March 13th, the president declared a national emergency under the National Emergencies Act. So two acts. What did each enable the government to do?
Well, you know, there were actually three emergencies called by the federal government, two by the president and one by the Secretary for Health and Human Services. They all did different things, but essentially what they do is that they release a funding for a surge response. They enhance the powers of the Department of Health and Human Services and the president to tackle it. And it also, I think importantly, waives a number of rules about things like, how quickly the Food and Drug Administration can license a test or a treatment or a vaccine, and provide some funding for the NIH and the CDC. And so basically it's cutting red tape, giving more powers, and releasing some funding.
Yeah, facilitating telemedicine, increasing hospital capacity. We heard also doctors could cross state lines. So there's some of the red tape that gets cut in the name of public health. But then there get to be stickier questions and, you know, constitutional questions about what can be done in the name of public health. We have travel restrictions on most non-U.S. citizens coming from 26 European countries. We know about that. Also bans on China, Iran, the U.K., Ireland. But, for instance, New Jersey's governor said, or he told us, he wants to try to stem the tide of workers who cross between New York and New Jersey, you know, primarily by telling people to stay home. But what else can you do? You say travel restrictions within the country can be constitutionally problematic.
Yeah, I do. So let's just come get back to basics. I mean, the president's power at the border is very, very wide. And as you say, he's well within his powers and rights to ban travel or to have enhanced screening, and he's done that. But the president has very limited power of for doing anything within states, and indeed, while governors have a lot of power within their states, it's very, very unclear whether either the president or a governor could actually ban travel from, say, New York to New Jersey.
Well President, but I just want to ask you, what if a state had an extraordinary outbreak? Could there be something that I've seen in your writings, a cordon sanitaire, where you cordon off a state or a locality and no one comes or goes?
Yeah, I mean, certainly within a state, and we're beginning to see this, within a state, you know, governors or mayors have set up what they call a cordon sanitaire. It's really just basically a perimeter where people should not come or go. They certainly did that in China and Italy and other places. And we're beginning to do it in the United States. I think so long as that's, you know, proportional, that we're not using draconian measures to punish and enforce, that we probably would be within our powers. But it just gets tricky when you try to ban travel from one state to another. You know, in living memory, in fact, I can't even in my historical examination of modern American history, we've never had a domestic travel ban. Mm. In fact, the federal government even rarely advises Americans not to travel to state X or Y. The last time they did that was during Zika, warning pregnant women not to travel to South Florida. But it's very rare. And if it were a complete ban, certainly the Supreme Court would have to review it.
Yeah. You list principles in the latest Journal of the American Medical Association article that you wrote. You list principles to follow in creating public health policy. We'll link people to that at hereandnow.org. But you say coercive measures, and we only got about a minute here, but coercive measures should be proportionate to the threat. Do you believe that's happening now?
Well, so far, yes, so far, generally so. I mean, I always think that good science leads to good ethics, leads to good law. And so the science really is telling us that in quite significant physical distancing is necessary. So closing schools, closing businesses like restaurants and bars, asking people to shelter in their home. I think those are all reasonable precautions that government should take. Of course, we're not China, and we don't believe in draconian social control, intrusive surveillance. They even had citizen informers and electronic bracelets that occurred in China. So I think our enforcement would have to be. We don't want armed police. Right. We want to just have, try to gain the cooperation of the population, and we need to gain it.
Yeah. Professor Lawrence Gostin, he's with the Institute for the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown and director of the WHO Center on Global Health Law. Professor, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.